Good evening. This is Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. And I also want to encourage the people to listen to my archives at www.gimmesometruth.info. And this is where all the programs are archived. And I have a special guest this evening. She's back again, but her research is ongoing. And I really do feel that it's very pertinent that we keep up with Jenny Lake, because she's connecting some dots that others haven't quite seen as much, even though there is a growing concern over vaccinations. There's a whole lot more to the story, and Jenny goes back to the very beginning and origins of how we are where we are today. And Jenny, I'm going to let you say hi and tell us a little bit of your background, and then we'll get right into your research, current research.
Well, hi, Melody, and hello to everybody listening. I think this is my third time on Truth Quest with you, and that's delightful to me. When I was a nursing student about 6 years ago, and I was given a project in school to look for the cause of a disease. And I had a partner in class, and we were allowed to choose the disease, so we chose polio. And my instructor tried to talk us out of it, and she said, well, that's a dead disease. That's not relevant to anything today. But, you know, she finally capitulated and let us do the project. And to my utter amazement, I went looking for the real cause of polio and discovered that it was caused by radiation and chemicals. It's not a contagious disease, although my nursing textbooks say this is a contagious childhood disease. So this just started the ball rolling, and it's led me very deeply into looking at the nuclear program and looking at the whole medical establishment and how it's been militarized to serve our weapons programs. And to me, this is the bottom line. This is why we have the kind of medical care in this country that we have. They're not looking for cures for disease. Cancer, in particular. Why haven't they cured cancer? There have been so many cures that have been brought forward, but it hasn't happened. So the research that I'm doing is all based on learning as much about the science and then coming up with alternative theories and having that shape my questions and the next steps that I take. And what I believe at this point is that we're moving into what they call the post-human age, where our species is being altered so that we no longer have many of the characteristics of being human beings as we did. So the immediate goal is then to eliminate the capacity of human beings to be a free living species. And this is what I believe at this point. And many of the events that have been happening, the BP oil spill and the Fukushima meltdown, these events play into this in a very big way. And I think what they're doing is vectoring synthetic biology, that the chemtrails and all the biological material that's there, these mixed compounds of what they call metallorganics. These are biological fragments of DNA and things that have been fused with tiny nanometal particles. This type of stuff is now being used in transgenics. And this is very likely what's falling out of the sky, in addition to fibers and many other things. So this is the big story, and this is the big picture. How soon will they have us in the state of not being a free living species anymore? I can't say for sure, but I think it's close at hand. And with this contamination that's come from Fukushima, or so they say, the radiation levels in the world right now are assisting a very rapid uptake of this bioremediation, this engineered biology.
There are, I'm going to try to attend a conference this weekend in Santa Fe on the 22nd, 23rd, and with Clifford Carnicom's Institute. And if I can get everything arranged, that's what I try to, well, at least hit one day of it. But he has some connections, too, if you've followed any of his work, right? Or are you aware of?
Some. I visited his website. I've looked specifically at some of the results of the tests that they've done. You know, they're kind of doing their own chemistry work, precipitating out whatever is falling from their from the sky into their samples. So I'm following some of this. It's fascinating stuff. Gotta say, you know, that with what Morgellons disease, which is, you know, now sort of really reaching people's consciousness, it's not just about extruding fibers out of your skin, but it's extruding microdots and all kinds of little crystalline particles, things of various colors and very determined shapes. You know, this is where neuroscience is at the moment. Nanosensors, this nanotechnology. You know, there's been quite a lot of talk over the last decade about creating nanomachines that synthesize drugs internally, particularly in case of cancer. So, you know, I keep going back to the history of this. I keep going back into the history of nuclear power. And
medicine.
And medicine. Well, you know, this is it. This is the point, is that when Eisenhower left office, he's sort of famous for having made this this televised speech where he was warning the public about the military-industrial complex. And, you know, I think about what it was like to have maybe listened to that at that time. I would have thought, probably like other people thought in the 1950s, well, a military-industrial complex, that's a good thing. That means that we have a strong military. And we believed at that time that having a strong military meant that we were defending freedom and human rights all over the planet. And yet, he didn't tell us anything, because if he wanted to say something enlightening, if he really wanted to warn the public, he would have said military medical industrial complex. And that would have actually said something, because ultimately, to me, That's the seed point of all of it. Our nuclear program grew out of technologies that were developed and used for medicine. Hospital laboratories then became actually places of strategic military importance, what was going on there. And our whole knowledge in the field of genetics arose out of this science, using X-rays, exposing things to radioactive materials. We learned about how malleable and mutable we are from exposing biological material to radiation. So these sciences have been wholly dependent on this development, on weapons development.
It almost reminds me of the statement made by Rahm Emanuel, is never let a disaster go to waste. And all these nuclear accidents may not be, you know, something looked upon as a disaster on their part, as something, an opportunity for them to study the effects.
Well, and they may not be accidents. And I think particularly when looking at Fukushima, you know, what struck me beyond, you know, beyond things that were buzzing around the internet, when I looked at it, you know, what they said, the tsunami really caused that accident, that the earthquake knocked out power, and then it was the tsunami that came in after that just sort of, like, took everything down. And to me, I've gone back and I've looked at programs that were put out on cable TV, and, you know, just sat there with a notebook and wrote down at the times when the tsunami struck each place where they had film, and there were places that were of equivalent distance from the epicenter that got the tsunami as much as an hour apart. And, you know, this is just not possible. So we've been hoaxed on this story. About a month or so after March 11th, they released a video saying, here, this is an image of the tsunami hitting the Daiichi plant. And it was just an image of a big wave, you know, that looked like it was breaking against the seawall. And down in the foreground were all these leafy little trees. And this is what I noticed right away when I looked at it. And I remember that watching the coverage, it snowed in the days after. It's cold there. It's winter there. And yet in this video that they're trying to tell us was taken on March 11th, there are these small trees out in front in full leaf. So I went back. I went into the news. I was looking at other times, what their cyclone season was like. And I'm very convinced myself that the video that they're saying was the March 11th tsunami was taken during a cyclone, and that was just a normal breaker on a stormy sea, because that's exactly what it looks like. And, you know, it's very strange. There were two programs that really got my attention. One was called Megaquake, The Hour That Shook Japan. And then very recently, September, the NOVA PBS made another video called Japan Killer Quake. And they used the same footage, some of it coming from the very same person, a guy who happened to be in Japan on behalf of the Sea Shepherds. This guy's name was Brian Barnes. And Brian Barnes, that turns out, is a tornado chaser from the Midwest. He doesn't know anything about earthquakes and tsunamis. But in the first program that was broadcast, and I believe this went on the air probably at the end of April, he says he would just, it's amazing. Here he was. He was just caught in this event. And he decided he was going to start filming a few seconds before the tsunami was supposed to hit. But in some blogs and in some other stuff that was released about him and his footage, it turns out that he'd actually been visiting this town for over 2 weeks. They'd been coming and going, this small group of people. They were there as dolphin activists, and their purpose there was to document what was going on in that town, to document the fishing practices of the locals. So they apparently had a lot of footage. You know, and then there were just so many things wrong with it. They had sirens going in the background while Brian Barnes and his friends are trying to flee in a car. And they say, oh, are we hearing sirens? And somebody else says, yes, you know. And the real story of this town called Atsuchi, where they were, is that Atsuchi had no power. There were no tsunami sirens for those people. And it's a matter of news documentation that there was a fireman in the town who got up on the roof of the fire station to ring an old-fashioned bell, and that was the only warning that those people had. And that man was swept away in the tsunami.
Wow.
So it's just one lie after another after another. And then NOVA comes along. Right, 6 months later, they release another program, and they use the same footage, but it's in a wholly different situation. They say they're in a different city and everything. it's an amazing hoax. I'm astonished. I'm really astonished. So I had to write that and put that up on my blog.
Well, you know, one of the things that struck me when you know everybody was out trying to measure the radiation levels, and they got me totally confused on how to go about it and if you could go about it. But the what really came home to me was looking at it and going, you know, I have to wonder how much of this was already here before they ever started measuring Fukushima. And we weren't doing it because we weren't focused on it. We don't know how much radiation is floating around. I mean, there may be people that do, but if they do, they're not necessarily, they haven't been telling us, or it wasn't in the mainstream for us to be aware of.
Well, that's right. That's an excellent point, Melody. You know, our radiation monitoring system is not out there just for the general atmosphere. That's not why it's there. They've constructed this whole system at existing radiation sites. So all the readings that we're going to get are going to be a combination of what's locally immediate right there in addition to what's in the atmosphere. So there's probably no way we would get accurate readings on that anyway. But there's some really strange things going on. There's a public, it's not public access in the sense that you and I can go and get information from the site, but volunteers from the public provide the data that goes to this site. They call it the RadNet. And there are people who blog about RadNet. They're RadNet volunteers. And I went to some of those sites. There's people in Berkeley, for example, who discussed RadNet information. And people were saying that there were all kinds of spikes going on all over the place. And this is way before Fukushima. You know, in the early weeks of March, in the very beginning, there were spikes in one place or another. There are places that they know of that are rather routinely spiking radiation. So, you know, I just, as this stuff became presented to the internet just for the general dissemination, I wanted to pick up on some of the themes, the stuff people were talking about, things that were making a splash in the alternative news community, like infant mortality, for example. And I looked at the infant mortality statistics, and I went back 10 years and looked at that, and there is not a discernible spike in infant mortality in the right place at the right time. So there are so many factors involved in that, including the fact that, you know, the whole health system has been under siege, being gutted for funds from the government since 2005. A couple of years ago, I was looking at the flu in 2009, because that was when we were supposed to have our H1N1 pandemic, the pandemic they were all talking about. The setup for that, of course, was the bird flu that preceded that. We were supposed to be seeing that spreading around the world in 2005. And that's the point at which federal funding was getting pulled out of our laboratory system, our public health laboratories. It was amazing to me to see the diminishment of the capacity of those labs. At the very same time, the government was building up a program that they call GEIS. It stands for the Global Emerging Infection System. They call it GEIS, GEIS. And GEIS is run by the Navy, pretty much, and I think all the armed forces cooperate in this. But this is a global network of laboratories that do disease surveillance, probably very similar to what the WHO is doing. I'm sure the WHO is a large partner to the GEIS program. But while the laboratories at home, right here, were getting gutted for funds, GEIS was given five times the amount of its budget from one year to the next.
Let me point something out I just ran across yesterday. I know it seems not related, but it just kind of implicates some of what you're talking about here, because this is, again, looks like it's become a global program. I just found on United States Forest Service website that we have a United States Forest Service is kind of an international organization.
Doesn't surprise me.
and so, I mean, they're out there helping others, but there was somewhere on the site, it was mentioning how they had to stop with locals somewhere and bring in international people because they ran out of funding. Now, that kind of flies in the face a little bit as well. And then I went on your RadNet website, and I'm looking at it a little bit, and I'm noticing that they have the 10 regions that that they're utilizing for doing the radiation sampling. And I just thought it was kind of curious, too, for those of us that have followed some of the how they are breaking everything into regions in our country as it is, I mean, which is kind of subverting our states' rights and our local control. And, I mean, everything's related in some way, form, or fashion. And I know this seems, again, a little off topic, but you know, when you start looking at everything being dealt with on a global basis and regions, you know, and that's the new governmental entity area that we will start following under and working within so that we don't even have a local control. And so, but get back to your issue.
Right. Well, you know, and that, like, the path of broadcasting took this path also. You know, as they were concentrating radio broadcasting, the local stations then didn't even have the programming to have their own local news. So you couldn't turn on your local station and find out what was going on in your area.
Oh, that's very prevalent. I found that. I just took a trip out to Oregon and back and found that finding local news was, you know, pretty much a toughie if you were on AM, FM radio. And it was very, very, just little sound bites of it at best. But even on your NPR stations, now they were trying to point out, saying that they were, oh, this is Utah Public Radio or Nevada Public Radio. But it was the exact same programs that I was listening to on all the other programs.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess this contributes to the mass hypnosis like nothing else, you know?
Okay, well, I would like you to go back and start at the beginning a little bit on your article that you have on your website. I had it there. Where did I put it?
On my blog?
On your blog or on the polio particular. Because, I mean, this information, I think, is so key to understanding where we are today and where it's going. I had the opportunity to see a program last night that was on Discovery Channel, and it happened to be one of the Mythbuster guys on there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about what it would be like if he, you know, had lived into 2099 and all the medical advances. Well, it was pretty eye-opening where all this was going, and if people have a chance to catch his program, because I'm sure they'll repeat it, it's real interesting to see how it would be so easy to go into these areas, and yet I can see that a lot of this technology isn't going to reach the majority of us. It's going to be definitely for the specific people. But
maybe if there aren't so many of us,
right?
We can manage that, right?
Right. But when I look at some of these people like Rockefeller and Maury Strong, whatever, these guys, you know, they don't seem to get older. I mean, they do, but they maintain it for a long time. But I'm wondering now if they're even walking around in the same body. But I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Who knows? You know, they actually can mimic a living human being through video quite convincingly these days. So that was one of the TED seminars, the TED seminars that they have out in Long Beach, and they have a lot of that stuff online. Fascinating, because they're really demonstrating the up and coming technology and what they can do in computer graphics, which is to do something that this has long been a goal, which is to imitate a human being from a completely digital input and have that image look like a photograph and function like an actual film of someone.
And then again, there's the possibility that they have a stand-in or, you know, people that are made to look like these people. It's hard to say, but I can see advantages to those who like to be in control of everything. That would be very advantageous. Mm-hmm. But getting back to your work on the polio and how it all began, I find it very fascinating. So I would like to see you kind of get into that and kind of work your way through that, because it's I'm not hearing the dot connecting like you have done with the radiation aspect. So
okay, well, no, I wound the history back to the beginning of nuclear technology, which is to be its X-ray equipment. You know, X-rays were almost faddish the way they were taken up. An electrical engineer could easily build an X-ray machine. They were very simple to make. And so they had people who had no qualifications as doctors or medical experience of any kind using X-rays on people and devising treatments for people. And of course, this just, you know, it exploded around the globe. All the Western countries, you know, people had X-ray equipment all of a sudden. I think the English dragged X-ray equipment into the Boer War in South Africa, 1903 or thereabouts. So this just became so pervasive in such a short period of time.
Now, didn't the mining of uranium really explode at that time, too?
Yes. Okay. Well, now the Curies, Marie Curie's gone down in history as someone who, you know, purified radium. And it's right in this little same window of time, say about 5 years of time, the X-rays and the radium came into existence. And all of that was just taken up very quickly. Medical use was the most available and tangible application for that stuff. So they just put it to use right away. And, of course, X-rays, you could find shrapnel in a soldier with an X-ray machine. So you can see that there was an immediate strategic interest for the military to have X-ray equipment. And you know, it worked its way very quickly into labs. I mean, our whole medical infrastructure was just falling into place right at the turn of the 20th century. I think it was 1902 when what had been the Marine Hospital Service got a new name, and they called it the Public Health Service. It had nothing to do with public health. This was before the military exclusively.
You say that name again? It was the what before it became the...
It was called the Marine Hospital Service.
Okay.
And they founded this back in the revolutionary days, you know, in the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Back then, they created this Marine Hospital Service as a way to offer help and assistance to the mariners, to the merchant marines of that time, you know, this was the military that we were dependent on as a nation to guard our coasts. And so the Marine Hospital Service was created for their benefit. And during the Civil War, there was expansion of this. The Marine Hospital Service had sort of like the first medical bases that were used during the Civil War. And the need to expand that and to start actually running hospitals became part of their authority at that point. But in 1902 is when they changed the name to the Public Health Service, and they affiliated it with what was called the U.S. Hygienic Lab. And that eventually became our National Institutes of Health. But at that time, it was a small outfit, a very small operation. I think they had one small building. It had one director, and he had a very small staff. And, you know, his job at that time was to take on the tasks that he was asked by the government. And this was on the behalf of the military, almost always. Now, there were a few things that caused this to expand. There was an outbreak of bubonic plague in San Francisco, and this was a recurring thing, and they said it was being caused by Chinese immigrants who were coming in. And that there was, you know, a lively Chinese community there. These are people who had come, and a lot of them worked on the railroads out there and so on. But this bubonic plague, they created a federal commission on bubonic plague, and the people that were assigned to that commission, it was very small, was the director of the U.S. Hygienic Lab. His name was Milton Rosenau. The director of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, which was brand new, and his name was Simon Flexner. And then another man who had been someone with some executive power at the Johns Hopkins Medical School. And his name was Llewellyn Parker, and he was also affiliated with the Rockefeller. So having been sort of in the right place at the right time, the Rockefeller establishment got very cozy with our government quickly in providing medical services, laboratory services. This is something that, you know, general doctors around the country would never do. They didn't have access to labs. Medicine wasn't being practiced in that way. But they changed it. You know, through almost unlimited funding, they were able to really dictate the course of the research. And, you know, we think they just sort of slipped in there and took over. It really wasn't that easy for them. They spent many years of trial and error at the lab bench doing different kinds of work to create filtrates. The whole idea and concept of viruses was new at that time. And this was the direction in which they were taking things. Well, and, of course, well, I was going to say, what you can't leave out about Rockefeller is that by the 1900s, he personally was the wealthiest man in the world, so it's believed, that he had such a horrible reputation with Standard Oil, double dealing and cheating people and massive corruption, that he was ready to retire at that point, and he was being dogged by these antitrust elements in our government because this was the muckraking journal type of era where his name was just getting dragged out in public, and he was despised. So he really did, as far as I'm concerned, create the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research to give him a clean public image, to show that he could be a do-gooder. And he certainly did, you know. I mean, it had that effect in the long run.
To do good, or was it hiding?
No. I mean, it did that to his image.
Oh, okay.
It made people tolerant and forgiving towards his, you know, brutal, rapacious, robber baron ways. Because they actually believed in that scientific medicine was the way of the future, that this meant progress.
Okay, now when you're talking about some of these institutes spending time trying to come up with all these different systems of working through it, doing their lab work, but wasn't it based on a flawed concept in the first place, or am I incorrect?
No, well, I think the concept they were basing it all on was germ theory. And, you know, germ theory was developed from bacteriology. And as we know, bacteria are living organisms. But the whole, if you want to call it a science, I would call it a pseudoscience, absolutely. The science of virology, the viruses, they were attempting to apply viruses that they were actually creating in laboratories and used the same principles as bacteriology and put the rules of germ theory in application to viruses. And as far as I know, this has never worked. It doesn't work. A virus is not a living organism. A virus is just a crystalline fragment of DNA. And if people want to go to a website called virusmyth.com, they can read some wonderful things from scientists who talk about viruses as just parts of cells. This is what they are. They're just genetic components of cells. And as they spread into the environment and into our cells, they actually, you know, facilitate the processes of evolution. And so these are not the wild, scary pathogens that we think are just out there waiting for us to pick them up and get sick. But this is a very important part of how we exchange genetic material with the environment. And the polio virus now is considered one of the best known, most studied, and been around for the longest time. And it's also among the smallest of the viruses. There's no evidence that polio, up until at least the 50s and beyond, was ever caused by a virus. Polio victims in the 1950s were analyzed for the presence of this virus, and it was overwhelmingly not there. It was really not until after the vaccine that polio virus began to manifest in people.
So in other words, it's like they kind of created what they needed so that they could get this machine rolling,
well,
whatever it was.
I have a theory about this, because I know that polio is caused by radiation, and we know that radiation causes cancer and genetic damage, that the whole polio vaccine, in a way, was a cover for an anti-cancer vaccine. Because when they made the first polio viruses, we didn't have this virus, you know. I mean, the vaccine. If polio had been such a problem in the world, we would have had a vaccine sooner, most likely. The reason why we didn't have a vaccine until the mid-50s is because they didn't have the material that they wanted to grow the polio viruses on. That was harvested in 1951, and it's coincident with the opening of the Nevada test site and the fact that now fallout was going to be spread all over North America, and it was going to start causing cancers in people in a short time.
So you're saying they kind of knew this then?
Yes, they knew this.
And that they have to have specific mediums to grow some of the things that they want for various vaccinations, that you're not, you're kind of...
Yes,
not...
well, a virus will, in this case, poliovirus and many viruses will actually uptake genetic material that they're grown on. So they'll incorporate that into their little crystalline fragment.
Uh-huh.
And they can do the same. The viruses can then pass the genetic material into the host.
So it's kind of like genetic modification, GMO organisms, in a sense.
Yeah, very much. Like transgenes.
Okay.
Yep. And in 1951, this strikes me as very interesting. There was a patient, a woman who had a very aggressive cervical cancer. Her name was Henrietta Lacks, and they took her tumor in February of 1951. It so happened that we were actually undergoing a nuclear test at the time. It was the first project at the Nevada test site. It was called Operation Ranger, and it was in January and February of 1951. But she had been a tobacco farmer. And I don't think she herself used tobacco in any way. I think it was just something that she handled in her life. And when I was looking at bringing radioactive minerals into the world with radium, what we already mentioned at the beginning of the 1900s, one of the uses for radium, they say, and I think it was actually the depleted uranium, which would have been a byproduct of that, was using it as fertilizer. And there was a company in 1911 called Standard Chemical Company, and I don't even know if it's related to Standard Oil, but it's possible. But Standard Chemical Company packaged what they called radium fertilizer, and they were encouraging farmers to use it. And they ran their own experiments trying to demonstrate that you could get nice, lush plants if you just put some of this radioactive fertilizer on them.
Well, you know, that, so, again, that goes back to those bee videos or bee movies that they were coming out where they
like a 50-foot tall woman?
Yeah, yes, and the giant killer tomato, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, it's almost like that. Yes, you know, if fiction is always best when it draws on true life, I guess. But, you know, I'm not able to really track where this radium fertilizer went and who was using it. But I think that, you know, for a non-food crop, tobacco has been one of the most valuable crops pound for pound.
It's a
more valuable commodity than food. And it seems like a natural to me that tobacco fields would have been a prime recipient for some of that radioactive fertilizer.
That would be fairly easy to go and follow through with if a lab was willing to look into that, I wonder, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there have been a lot of things said about the carcinogenicity of smoking. Is that it's not the smoking that's the problem. It's polonium that gets into people's lungs. And polonium is a breakdown product of radium.
Oh my goodness!
So there, to me, there's a logic in all of that.
That
must mean that they were putting radioactive fertilizer on tobacco fields. That would have increased their profit margin. They would have got bigger, lusher plants, and that there would have been plenty of economic reasons to do
but
that.
But if you were also building up a medical industrial complex and you had also needing to get rid of a byproduct of something, you start putting it together and,
And you sell it. That's exactly what Rockefeller did. He was a freak for efficiency and no waste. And any kind of waste in his industry was a disturbance to his bottom line. So he made sure that anything that he had control over, that all byproducts became useful commodities in some other way. And of course, this is our green agenda today. It's zero waste, they call it.
Well, I'm going to just bring up something that just came out in my paper. I know it's a little sidestep, but when you're talking about waste, this is what's coming down the road from our water system. They have just filed in our newspaper today, it says the absolute and conditional exchange of reusable sewered return flows. And I did answer a poll about a year or two ago that had to do with, you know, they were asking us what, you know, we excreted and if we took any kind of medications, if we had pets. You know, this was all stuff that was going to go into the sewer system. Mm-hmm. So I can see down the road there is something up their sleeve for charging us. And not that we're not already paying for it, because we do have those kind of fees, but I think that they're going to see a much bigger market in whatever waste is coming out and or fees to pay for whatever waste is coming out. So.
Well, I think that's possible.
Right. And I see that reusable water or recycled water fits right into what you're talking about with Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just to continue the point, you know, that when the picture is big enough, these things are not circumstantial anymore. You know, it just all looks very planned. And it looks like they were just poised to, for, you know, had their feelers out to find the perfect cancer, to find the cancer that would be the mother cancer for growing viruses on for an anti-cancer vaccine. And so this happened in 1951. And the cells that were taken from that tumor were then distributed to a variety of certain elite laboratories that were working on polio vaccine. And the Manhattan Project scientists, quite a number of them, actually ended up being on the staff of the Salk Institute when that was created in the very beginning of the 60s. And one of those men, his name is Leo Szilard, went up to the University of Minnesota in order to teach them how to use cancer cells to grow polio viruses. And those are the very those are the very viruses that were used in the Salk vaccine.
Do you think these people were aware, all of them aware of what was going on here, or were they told a story?
We've been told the story.
Okay.
This was completely planned. So my theory is that, knowing what I know about this, that the scientists themselves who are working on it, that was in league with certain elements within the government and within private philanthropy to push this idea that they were making a dual-use vaccine. It was, yes, for polio, but it was for cancer. Because all of this nuclear testing, of course, was irradiating everyone, that this would bioaccumulate in such a way that within 5 to 15 years, there would be an excess of cancer in the world. And there's an additional element to that vaccine, and that was the inclusion of something called the SV40 virus, which stands for simian virus number 40. And after they created their HeLa cell cancer polioviruses, they took them and they grew them en masse on monkey tissue. And from the monkey tissue, they additionally took up a monkey virus. So we have cancer genes. And I'm going to put quotes around that because that needs a lot of definition. We have cancer genes and we have monkey virus now in the Salk vaccine.
Okay, but also explain what the polio is. I mean, my understanding from what you've written is that it's an inflammation of the brain, right?
That's right. It's an infection of the brain. It does a lot of particular damage in the brain stem area, which is the motor, where the motor nerves are. It can inflame the spinal cord as well. It takes a particular route in the spinal cord where it affects the motor nerves. So people end up having paralysis, and that's essentially what polio is. It's the paralysis that people have.
Okay, so if you already have that introduced into the body, and then you have something like, because there's somewhere in your article, you're also mentioning that getting an X-ray of the spinal cord can contribute to the paralysis. Is that right?
Yes, it can contribute to the progression of neurological disease. And it doesn't have to be the spinal cord. You could just get an X-ray, and you start that process.
Wow.
So This is like having your nervous system disintegrating, and that's what polio was really doing. But what the polio researchers themselves discovered was that encephalitis, which is a brain inflammation was present in all cases of polio. And what's been so deceptive about polio is that 99% of the people who have it have the flu. That's what they have. And then it goes away. And they never know that they've had polio. They just think they had the flu.
Well, that's the body, when it reacts to toxins, particularly in certain dosage levels, has a very similar reaction to any toxin. So, yeah. And then you get that catch-all term flu, right. Then...
Well, but the thing is that polio is a catch-all term, too. We just didn't know that, because we've been told all these years, you know, I mean, if people even pay attention, you know, it's like being in school. She's like, well, that's a dead disease. Nobody pays attention to that. We conquered that disease, you know. So the thing is, polio is a catch-all as well, and there are at least dozens of viruses that are known to reproduce that disease. It has nothing to do with the polio virus. And the situation that we're in now, of course, you know, we're vaccinating everybody in the whole world. In places like Nigeria, if you don't get a polio vaccine, you go to jail.
Okay, so ultimately when they're vaccinating them, they're stimulating the immune system, and then they get the immune system to either overreact or underreact, or wear itself out. I guess that would kind of fit in the underreacting part, right?
So yeah, but it channels the immune response, and that's something that all vaccine viruses do, is that they create a situation where the immune system is going to respond to exactly what was in that vaccine. And of course, you know, I mean, I think the whole thing is so controversial with viruses as being at the root of any disease that, I mean, I personally just don't even believe that anymore. So this is just such a poor way of dealing with it. But the frightening aspect is that it channels the immune system to respond to this very specific set of genes.
Okay, all right. So, and that's where the immune, where you have something like your allergies, it's so anything, once that you have enough toxins addressed, you become allergic to anything and everything?
Including yourself, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea of what I said in the beginning about eliminating our capacity to be a free living species, you know, this is bioengineering us to the point where our immune responses are so channeled and so controlled that, you know, we just no longer possess the ability to get outside this box, you know? And they're going to expose us to certain things, other probably bioengineered life forms that, you know, will challenge us in very specific ways. So they could be adapting us toward the bioengineering matrix that they're creating. And they could also just be, you know, via process of attrition, you know, knocking us out, because we will fail to adapt appropriately to naturally occurring changes.
Okay, wouldn't that be kind of like adapt... gearing us towards the survival of the fittest?
Well, you know, that somehow that doesn't even seem to apply anymore.
Okay.
You know, our immune system used to be like that, you know, and that's another interesting part of this research, is that, you know, I've learned that even without a prior exposure, human beings are capable of so an infinite number of immune responses to novel antigens that we will adapt. We can develop the antibodies and everything else that we need to resist infection. So the natural process of an emerging disease, something that's new, would be that initially there's a high mortality rate. Lots of people die. You know, something like Ebola, 80-90% of the people that get infected would die. But if this persists in the environment, that number goes down, that there begins to be an immunity that people will react with, you know, and the body starts developing an immune strategy. And eventually, over a long period of time, this is still in the environment, this is reduced down to a very low mortality rate. And something that's almost been conquered, in a sense, then becomes a childhood disease. And you see that in that case, in order to be healthy and strong, it's beneficial to have exposure to that, because that will strengthen the immune system. The immune system only has one way of growing strong, and that is through challenge. So, you know, things that emerge into the natural environment, things that we're going to be required to live with for a long time, we really do want that exposure, in a sense. We want to be able to allow that to run its course.
Okay, but see, I think where the problem comes with that is that the body has a normal way of dealing with these, but to introduce it into the bloodstream is a challenging factor.
Yes.
That I would, okay?
Exactly, because you bypass everything that's there as the first line of defense. You bypass it all by putting something directly in the bloodstream. So your last line of defense is actually to have an infection, to get sick from it, and then have, you know, all the components of your natural immunity in your blood system take over. So, you know, it's like suppressing the symptoms of a sickness. Suppressing the creation of the immunity.
What you're seeing possibly happen is they are trying to suppress that, our ability for the immune system to work correctly.
Right.
Okay.
Now, why would they do that, Melody? You know, I mean, my question ultimately is like, if they want to, you know, reroute our natural immunity and deprive us of natural immunity, it's got to be because they're going to be exposing us to genetically engineered life forms that they want to have come and inhabit our
kind
body.
Kind of like with when you do a organ transplant.
So the anti-rejection medication, in a sense. You know, when you have immune suppression, you're not able to mount a defense and reject something.
I'm just throwing out questions there, because I could just see the minds that go and just have free reign to start thinking of all this stuff. It's just phenomenal.
Whole body irradiation is like taking an anti-rejection medication. Yes, you can't reach. You won't be rejecting what comes next. And so, you know, to look at a nuclear accident on the scale of Fukushima, given that it's not an accident, that this was a planned sabotage, and, you know, there's so many elements of that event that signal to me that that's probably what happened.
And we can do a whole program on that alone, I'm sure.
Yeah. There must be another swing. There's got to be some big roundhouse punch coming after this, and it's biological. I think possibly that's already happened. I think that potentially the E. coli outbreak that happened in Germany, that started in May, when there was plenty of radiation all over the globe, that event, that may be a new seed point for vectoring some new genetics into the population.
And get into a little bit on what the advantageous to E. coli to those that are trying to create genetic manipulation.
Well, E. coli has then, as far as organism, now E. coli is a bacteria. It is a living thing. And it has a very large genome for a bacteria. They've been using E. coli in experiments for close to 100 years. I would say that, you know, from what I've learned, there's a virus. Let me put it this way so I don't get tongue-tied. Bacteria carry viruses as well. And just like our viruses, it's parts of the cell. And they call the bacterial viruses bacteriophage. And now bacteriophage has opened up the secrets to the genetic scientists for transferring genetic material from one bacteria to another. They discovered that the phage is a vector of transformation. And E. coli, of course, exchange their phage all the time. So by uncovering phage, they were, you know, had their own academic reasons for wanting to use phage in genetic experiments so that they could sort of, you know, graft on new genetic material and have it transferred from one bacteria to another or one species of bacteria to another.
Or from one animal to another?
Or from one animal to another. And they've known about this for a long time. One of the pioneers of bacteriophage was a man named Felix de Harel. I think he originally a Frenchman, but he came to Canada. He was in the United States. He was a self-taught microbiologist, but he made this discovery on how to use bacteriophage to at least work as an antibacterial agent, because the phage that he discovered were actually able to destroy other bacteria. So there are phages and viruses that destroy cells, and there are phages and viruses that integrate with cells. So, and sometimes it's the same, it's actually the same material in a different phase, but they have these two different actions. They can either kill off the cells in a, like a major infection or something, or they can just integrate into the cells. And this is their evolutionary aspect. This is how they, you know, bring genetic material in and around and spread it. So
ultimately, you could be taking the remains of a sewage plant and putting that on the food, which the genetic uptake and genetic uptake by the plants, which the people eat, and trying to find the correct ratio that it can be done, and or in the water, because, I mean, again, if you don't get it all out or you have a certain amount of that recycled water.
We have natural defenses against a lot of these things, but, you know, not against E. coli. We're actually well adapted to E. coli, and it's a normal part of our gut flora.
Okay.
And this is what's kind of has been scary in science all along, that E. coli was such an interesting subject, because as they were changing E. coli and they were introducing new genetic material, they were actually putting us at risk of having these, you know, new organisms disseminate out into the population. And I have no doubt that this has been happening. But things took a very scary turn around the turn of this millennium. In 2000 or so, some researchers at the Scripps Institute, which is actually right near the Salk Institute, and one of the men who worked on this project was a Salk Institute fellow,
Let me before we go any further, let me just say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and my guest this evening is Jennifer Lake. And I'm sorry if I didn't mention that earlier more often during the last hour, but she has done quite a bit of research on polio and other aspects in the medical field, but she has, you might mention your blog before you get further on that so that people know where to go to find your information.
I'll mention that now. I have a main blog that's jenniferlake.wordpress.com. I have one that's just dedicated to the subject of polio and a nuclear program, and that's called polioforever.wordpress.com.
Okay.
And then if they want to explore the blogs, there's a lot of linking going on between them. But as I was saying, we're talking about E. coli and the fact that there was a massive E. coli outbreak in May of this past year, just a few months ago, in Germany. I make an association of that outbreak to the Fukushima disaster, that when you spread radiation around, we just went over this the last hour, that it's like taking an anti-rejection medication. You become immunosuppressed, and then other things that are in the environment, pathogens, whatever, drugs, all these things have a greater effect, much more vulnerable to uptaking some kind of foreign material, much less able to resist it, because we all become immune compromised under certain conditions. And fallout conditions are notorious for that. But what they've been able to do with E. coli since 2000 is actually introduce artificial amino acids. And this is not just something that's been genetically engineered. These are new creations. Through all the vast millennia that we've existed, that we know of, that our entire genetic code on this planet, which is all the genomes of all the species, has been composed of 20 amino acids.
And now we have a lot more?
Now we have a few more, yeah.
Okay, and let me ask you this one question before you get too far out of this then. And amino acids are kind of put into the food category.
Okay.
And I've seen a lot of them introduced via the supplement industry. And since the supplement industry is being bought out by the pharma industry, it looks like a natural place to be able to do experimenting on the public with their and in their agreement and bypass the FDA. Just a thought.
That's possible. You know, that's certainly possible. You would have to test for these substances. So the tests have to exist initially. Then the requirements for the tests have to be in place. And I know that that may or may not be true necessarily for certain things. You know, rules of the FDA on supplements use a policy that they call generally regarded as safe. They call it GRAS.
Mm-hmm.
And that policy absolves them from a lot of testing, I think. But that's just – the whole thing is too canned right there. It would be too easy to test for it and find it and then find a culprit. So I don't think that that's the way this would happen. I mean, I think these conspiracies are so deep and so dark that they would choose a natural vector if they really wanted to do that. And E. coli would be a perfect vector for that.
Okay.
Because it's not only been, it's, you know, a lab specimen, a darling of the lab for so long, but they were very, very successful at getting E. coli to uptake these artificial amino acids. And they've proven themselves to replicate the artificial amino acids. And the aminos, of course, are, you know, they're the basis of all DNA, all protein. This is the stuff that mm-hmm. the whole genetic code is made of. So if you could vector artificial amino acids in E. coli, it would have a particularly profound effect on all mammals, because this is natural gut flora for all mammals. And what I thought was interesting, too, is that in 2010, they finally came out with a vaccine against E. coli for cows. But cows are naturally resistant to toxic E. coli. So, you know, why would you devise a vaccine against toxic E. coli for cows who are naturally immune to toxic E. coli?
Well, maybe it might be where they figure it'll end up and not have to do with the cow, but it's a good way to sell it.
Well, I think it may have something to do with the fact that cows are agriculturally more important than human beings. If you spread artificial aminos through E. coli, you would want the humans to contract that. Now, it's going to pass to all the mammals. So you inoculate the agriculturally important animals against toxic E. coli, and you allow this to spread in the human population.
And that's where I was saying it wouldn't be for the cow so much, but for the humans down the road.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. Now the cows would just, I really don't know what kind of effect that would have on a cow.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was a very strange outbreak. It was definitely a species of a subspecies of E. coli. I guess you would say a serotype, which was called the O104. And they were calling it novel, but I had to look at that and look in the literature for the first time that this went on the record as ever having been registered as in an outbreak. And the first time went back to 1994 in Montana. So it's not all that novel. It has been in a minor outbreak, at least. It's obviously it was an E. coli that had many of its parts. It accumulated parts that were resistant to antibiotics. So that means it's been around long enough to pick up all of these parts. So this is what the phage helped do, by the way, that they help transfer these parts. It's not the only way. There actually is bacterial conjugation in E. coli, but this just seemed to have a paper trail that made it very suspect to me as being a product of the laboratory.
Okay, now this movement that, I mean, went back to the period of time when Rockefeller created a lot of the institutions and that they had, overpopulation has been something that's been espoused about or talked about from the elites for years and millennia. And so when you have a group get together that maybe have created a life forms that they find to be more advantageous, like it would be kind of like what they've done to cattle or other types of dogs. I mean, you know, breeding them to the point where they want certain characteristics. It's as though that is what's taking place with us, and that we're being bred to have certain characteristics, or bred to the point where we don't are unable to exist in our current environment. It's such a broad. It could have such broad implications and can hide in so many, you know, nooks and crannies as other things that is being passed off to the public.
Well, I wouldn't use the term bred anymore. I wouldn't consider this breeding. we're being bioengineered.
Okay.
And all of these things that are coming our way, very high-tech materials that are coming into the food chain, coming down through the chemtrails, the fallout, this stuff is altering us in ways that have nothing to do with our heredity, which is what breeding is.
And the sinisterness, let me throw in one other factor, the sinisterness of inducing into our diet so many mediums that would grow whatever it is that's being introduced into the human population, like the high fructose corn syrup and the like.
Yeah, very interesting. At least one effect of the high fructose corn syrup, besides promoting a lot of pathogenic multiplication, is that it causes a lot of fat cells to form, gives you a lot more adipose tissue, which is where we store our toxic waste. I mean, our bodies try to sequester it into our fat tissue. And, you know, this is one way to at least keep it out of the bloodstream and keep it out of the brain. It's like you start adding up all these factors, and it just can't be a coincidence. You know, it can't be coincidental that, you know, that even more carcinogenic food additives are in the food chain now than were before. I mean, on a seems like a daily basis, there's something else to find out about that's now part of processed foods. So, and even nanomaterials have made it into the food chain.
You have when you look at the light bulb situation that they've come into, what is that all about?
The light bulb situation?
With the mercury and the new light bulbs that is going to be required for us to have instead of the current ones we have?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's more toxic stuff right at hand. You know, let's put this in your home. Like, you know, like smoke detectors that give off radiation. They want you to have one in every room. We're just surrounding ourselves with this electromagnetic storm of chemical, active, electrical material that's, you know, it's having an immense physiological effect on us. And maybe this is the point, you know, maybe it's there because it does facilitate this shift. It is going to be part of what allows this bioengineered material to take up residence in our cells. Now, we have absolutely no immune eyes with which to see this nanomaterial that gets into our bodies. It's so small that our immune systems don't recognize it, so it's completely invisible to the immune system. And we can just build this stuff up. You know, we could store this in our adipose tissue and who knows where else. And just literally sort of fill ourselves up with this material because there's no way for our immune system to recognize it and dispose of it. I think that's very alarming. I knew that by 2005, there were at least 300 products that had been identified as having nanomaterials in them. And these are molecules which have been rearranged in such a way that they have entirely new properties. And they can make it out of something like corn. They could call it corn. But it's, you know, it's not corn. They've gone down to the atomic level, and they've sort of re-engineered these things so that they have different electrical properties. They have, you know, as far as their what's biologically left of them is something that's, you know, beyond description. In terms of how our bodies are designed, we have no way of interacting with this biologically.
Okay, now, so, Jenny, when you get Mm-hmm. When you look at the work that these Rockefeller Institute and whatever started out being, one of the things that they seem to do is they do like to kind of tell us where they're going with it into the future, even if when we confront them, they deny it.
Well, that sounds pretty contrary. They're going to tell us on the one hand and deny it on the other.
But they do that. I've run across this so often in their work. And then I was listening to a speech by Aldous Huxley just recently stating that he was stating to the audience that they have to get us to acquiesce, to get the masses to go along. They have to try to introduce it in a way that we agree, even if it's sometimes done under devious means. It getting us to give our consent.
Right, the whole idea of manufactured consent. Well, I don't think they actually talk like this anymore. You know, they were certainly talking this way in the 1920s and 30s.
So which should give us a key as to what's happening now, right?
Well, yes, because, you know, actually there is sort of an evolution of propaganda language that will get us from there to here. I think people don't really understand what they hear anymore. We're so jingoistic in the way that things are said to us that it doesn't really have any meaning. So they're reducing much of our language to this babble. It just has no meaning at all. And it's very hypnotic, you know, for people mm-hmm. to hear this stuff repeated again and again. And, you know, it's just like what I said about Eisenhower warning us about the military-industrial complex. Well, in the 1950s, people would have thought a military-industrial complex. You have to have an industrial complex to support a military, and that sounds like a good thing. So people had no frame of reference for what he was talking about. And similarly, I think we've lost our frame of reference. Mm-hmm. In language, because we've been subject to this propaganda for so long.
Right.
And medicine is like that. You know, there are these just repetitive things that they say over and over again. It's, you know, for the benefit of humanity, we're going to cure disease because, you know, this is the only worthy cause. And so they can pretty much sell us anything if they slap that label on it. And we go for it. With that actually puts us to sleep. You know, we have a preformed concept of what that means. We heard it, our parents heard it, and our grandparents heard it, and our great-grandparents heard it. And by now, we're so asleep at the wheel that we take it for granted that there's some kind of very well-intentioned program out there, and we don't have to worry about a thing. So people don't really lift up the covers to look under at the science and see what they're doing. And, you know, when you understand how fundamental changes are being made into cells and to genes and what they're learning from the changes they're making, in transgenics, for example, I don't think there's any person who, if you just confronted them directly, say, you know, would you like to be crossbred with a tomato? People would just say, they'd laugh at you and they'd say no, right? So, but it's happening, and it's happening in laboratories, and they're doing this. And as far as they're concerned, all genetic material is a raw resource for their work. And this is a concept that Jonas Salk called metabiology. And he believed that we should do this. It was his philosophy that scientists should have carte blanche to use any kind of biological material as raw substance, and that they could do anything to it, recombine it, try to make it live, try to make living organisms take it in, recreate that, get those organisms to replicate. So we're doing this now we're beyond biology, in a sense, that we have new material. We have things called metamaterials. We have these hybrid materials between organic and non-organic, or traditionally what we've separated into categories. Can't separate that anymore because everything is being tried. And new properties are what they've been looking for. What can we do with this metamaterial? Can we, you know, can we use it in medicine? You know, I put this one article up on my blog called The Culture of Organs, and that was the title of a book that was co-written by a Rockefeller staff doctor and Charles Lindbergh. And Charles Lindbergh had an interest in this, and he was actually trying to work with this man and create a heart pump, create the first artificial heart pump. But what evolved out of this was the ideology that is now being used to actually create organs for human transplantation from scratch. And they do actually have the technology now where they can take part of a person's cells and have that grown, tissue culturing. They grow the cells so they have a lot of tissue. And then they take the cells and they can actually load them into something equivalent to an inkjet printer that will build layers of material in three dimensions, and they can actually create organs, living tissue organs that they can then use to transplant.
That reminds me of that program last night. I'm speaking to Jennifer Lake, and her blog is jenniferlake.wordpress.com, and the other one is polioforever.wordpress.com. So there is such vast applications with this, and there's so many avenues that it could be so great for humanity and animals and plants. And yet, it's just boggles the mind to see how it can be misapplied, and it is being misapplied in many many cases.
It is being misapplied. Yeah, it always seems to me a question of, you know, why are we going down this path with the technology when, you know, there's been so much to choose from. Like, why do we burn oil? You know, why do we build nuclear power plants? Why do we have this technology when we can have these other technologies?
Well, you know, one of the things you take the word organic. To them now, they've probably got a definition to where when they can truly say something is organic, which we would reject, but they can literally put the name word organic on, or, you know, with us burning fuels, burning petroleum, most of it, gasoline's made from, like, from my understanding, from like the 3 gallons that's left over after it's used for other means. So I can't imagine them ever letting go of that industry, and yet they blame it on us using it in our cars. But they found a way for us to pay for the waste product of the oil.
Exactly. Well, thanks to Rockefeller's genius, yeah, that was part of it. Well, you know, the way I understand it is that when Rudolf Diesel invented his combustion motor, he created it to run on peanut oil. So it was always going to be biodiesel in his design. And then, I don't know very much about this, but apparently he had a very mysterious death. He vanished. He was traveling somewhere, and he vanished, and his body turned up 10 days later, and nobody knew how he died. Apparently, they never released to the public any news about his death. But he died at a very convenient time for Rockefeller. And the other motors, you know, there were electric cars. Those were the first cars, really, were electric. They're running on batteries. And the designs that Ford had, to my knowledge, were all designed to run on alcohol. And I had a chance to have a be regaled by some great stories from a very old farmer who told me that he was a kid when Prohibition was enacted. And he said that what that caused at the time was, you know, at first nothing, of course, but eventually the farmers had always made their own fuel for their tractors and their trucks, and they were the classic makers of, you know, bathtub gin and had the still in the back, and that was to make fuel to run their equipment. And that, you know, it really forced people to change their ways, you know. But if you think about it, you know, how you can make alcohol out of so many things, any kind of bio-waste really would be appropriate for making alcohol. And if we had those kind of motors, who knows? Maybe we never would have used gasoline. No? That they had to find things to use gasoline for. And this is sort of how it's been. You know, whoever had a large stake in it and, you know, was able to pay for the science and the labs, and figure out what kind of applications. Well, you know, they really were the ones who dictated the direction that technology took. So that was just another aspect of Prohibition to me that seemed very, very important and useful to the same cartel that grew into big oil.
It's as though we become this big lab, and I've seen and heard those talk about the legislation that has equated humans now to animals, and that puts us into the category of being able to be manipulated down to the molecular genetic level. And one of the statements in your blog on the polio had to do with the fact that they weren't necessarily after the gene, but the genome. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
That's something right on the front page, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't even looked at that in a long time, but I've got my computer in front of me. This is a statement that was made by a doctor named Howard Ernovitz, and he was up in front of Congress testifying about Gulf War syndrome. He's sort of famously been in an argument, a scientific argument, with someone named Garth Nichols or Nicholson.
Okay, right.
Not sure. Okay. In any case, do you have the quote?
Yes, it says it's right under Eisenhower's picture on your blog, and it's Doctors Biskind and Scobie. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, I wrote.
Dr. Howard Ernovitz, does state it is that.
I'm suggesting that we're on the brink of losing the last domain, which we think is truly our own, which is our genes and our chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my words. And I said, if the establishment choice of treatment, which is genetic medicine now, they want to introduce genes into us, corrective genes. And this is the treatment. And I say, if the establishment choice of treatment is an indication of how we're being targeted for control, then Dr. Ernovitz's words are right on the money. And I'm quoting him now. It's not the germ, it's the genome. So they're telling us it's not the germs that are making us sick. The germs are not the cause of disease. The fault is in the genes. And so the treatment is going to be in bringing genetic correction to those faulty genes. It sounds very eugenical.
Well, and then you look at the electromagnetic radiation that we're being exposed to and how the genes does it not react to these energies?
Absolutely. And this is the whole thing. This is what gets left out of this whole discussion, is the fact that our genes take damage from radiation. It breaks our chromosomes apart. if the radiation is not, you know, we have two problems with radiation. Either we get chronic low exposure, in which case we fall behind on our ability to repair, or if we get very high doses where there's just so much damage that the system goes in shock, and we will misrepair a lot of things. So we're looking at a good chance of having damaged chromosomes after that. But chronic low exposure to radiation, like we get with fallout that hangs around for a long time, Chernobyl fallout, Three Mile Island fallout, this fallout within the atmosphere for years and years. And, you know, when you get that kind of damage, you're going to have a lot of genes damaged along the way. They say that most of the damage is really just going to affect tissues as they are, the proteins that have already been created by your DNA, more or less, you know. But as cells divide and there's more and more radiation, the chromosomes, the parts of the cells that carry the genetic instructions are going to get in the way, and they're going to get damaged. They'll break. A lot of them won't be repaired, and our immune system won't be able to keep up with eliminating all of this bad cell material to the point where we'll just be carrying this around. Some of this stuff will just survive sort of by default. And this is where new genetic diseases and things like that can then, you know, sort of enter the whole picture of our human heredity. We then will have these very strange genetic disorders, and they become hereditary at that point. Some of this now is, you know, part of the legacy of Chernobyl. A lot of genetic disorders. Some of these injured people have probably no chance of passing on their genes, but in some cases they will. Not all of this stuff is, you know, manifest as some type of hugely debilitating disease. Some of these things are, you know, they're below our ability to perceive them until they then manifest in another generation.
Now, one of the things that has always struck me as well is when these guys get into these lab technologies and the like, I would think that they try to come up with a way that they can convince themselves as, you know, a protectant for them so that they don't get the effects of everything that they're exposing the rest of us to. And are you familiar with Royal Rife's work?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. I know some things about what the harassment that he survived.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this was back in, I'm trying to think of his era, it was the 1920s, wasn't it?
Somewhere in there, right.
Okay. I know that you know, there was some kind of a face-off with the head of the AMA back in those days. I think that was Morris Fishbein, was the man mm-hmm. in charge of the AMA at the time. Then they burned his lab, and they burned his home, and I think they murdered his assistant, if I'm not mistaken. They did everything they could to frighten this man away.
And from the information that I recall, and this is going back from memory, but I thought his research had disappeared.
That's very possible. What's being touted as Royal Rife technology now may be some resurrected form of the work that could have been done by someone else,
okay.
Someone who learned from him. I have no idea. Personally, I don't mess with that stuff.
Okay.
You know, I'm open-minded about what people find benefit in if they really think so, but just sort of a natural caution has kind of imbued me at this point because of all of this work.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing is to understand nutrition, is to understand, you know, how the physiology of the body actually works so that you give it the best natural support that you can.
Okay, but, I mean, because all our, you know, we're being attacked on the, I mean, anywhere from vitamin C to the, you know, the Codex Alimentarius and the, our water and many things that air.
Milk.
Right.
Milk. They're attacking the milk.
Right. And so much of that, whatever is intake, the intake goes into the body, and this is why I've always looked at that. I don't know enough about it, and I don't know that there's enough of information about it out there in the public, but it would just seem to me that there's a key clue in that work that he has done that may have been, you know, taken and utilized further. I've seen it put into computer programs and the like, but frequency, since everything works off of frequency, it just seems to be a logical way that if there is information and an agent to protect those that are thinking that they're outside the parameters of everything else that we're being exposed to change us, because I can't imagine those that are involved with it really want to be a part of this lab, being a lab rat, but maybe, you know, maybe they're convinced of it as, you know, that it's doing them good. I don't know.
You mean the proponents of Rife technology, right? You're saying that the proponents of Rife technology may themselves be involved in an experiment that they don't know about.
Well, you know, I don't know how convoluted it can get, but
yeah,
but
well,
I'm,
I don't either. But mm-hmm. I know that I have no objective way of assessing mm-hmm. the. You know, whether or not this is an efficacious kind of therapy. I have no way of knowing
right.
that.
Right, and I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying what I'm trying to point out is those that may be involved in trying to change the populace with these bio weapons or biomechanic research, I would figure that if there is a nefarious reason behind it, they would have probably come up with some way to convince themselves that they're not subjected to it. Do you see what I'm saying? No?
Sorry, you could elaborate on that a little more.
Okay, well, I'm just saying it's kind of like, you know, it's, you know, I'm out there giving x-rays to somebody who's getting their teeth x-rayed, and so they put on a lead apron, thinking mm-hmm. that, you know, they're not being exposed to the radiation. When, you know, there's a lot of different ways that they can, you know, make these people think that, you know, they're not going to get, you know, succumb to whatever it is they're working with. And that's all I'm stating. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're fairly delusional, I think. You know, I mean, we all have a touch of it because we've all been subjected to much of this propaganda. Almost everywhere you turn, if you went for, you know, a mainstream education in something in any way, I mean, you've had your thoughts about that shaped.
Right.
And science is, you know, it's so overflowing, really, with fraud and deception. You know, I mean, this is another thing that, as someone who pursues alternative news, I just stumble on this on a regular basis. You know, studies that have been altered, studies that have, you know, not met the criteria of the directives of their grant programs or something. I mean, it's just one thing after another after another. So the science is very, very unreliable. You know what is reliable is, to me, human tradition, you know, things that we've been doing for so long that these are accepted and beneficial practices, and just about everybody can agree with that. You know, I mean, we started going wrong, in my opinion, as a species, you know, by not breastfeeding children. And you know, during the 1800s and the Victorian age, I mean, it actually, you know, was elevated to a something of a social status not to have to do that, you know? I mean, people used wet nurses if they couldn't breastfeed their children. But when the bottle baby era started, much of our disease and disease problems seem to have begun. And now you start coupling that with pollution in the environment from chemicals and radiation, things that bioaccumulate in our bodies because we're uptaking it in the foods. You know, we're concentrating that material, you know, to grow our very substance with. And, you know, we've just been on this very slow slide. You know, as, you know, someone who gets to work with patients, what I see in a lot of elderly is that their intestines fail. It seems like 9 out of 10 people that survive a long time find this to be actually the end cause of their aging, is that, you know, they just no longer have any intestinal fortitude left. There's the tissue itself, they can't colonize the beneficial bacteria. Well, when you expose a whole generation of people to atmospheric testing, you cause that deficit in that generation. Now, I'm very concerned about that time period, all through the 50s and into the middle of the 60s. And I'm part of this group, and I know myself, you know, that this is a deficit that I have trouble with. And, you know, I found solutions of my own that, you know, have been wonderfully helpful. And the reason I said milk before is because drinking fresh raw milk, that's part of my strategy to stay well. And yet, fresh raw milk from a farm is unlawful to sell to the public in 45 out of 50 states in this country. In the 5 states where it remains lawful to sell through a store, they're under constant harassment from agricultural representatives, public health officials. There's been a couple of raids on raw food co-ops. And very recently, very, very recently, just in the last couple of weeks, I think, there was a judge in Wisconsin. His name was Judge Fiedler from Madison, Wisconsin, who put a ruling out that the owners of cows have no legal entitlement to drink the milk from their own cows. And that's a first that I know of. So this is scarier to me than Codex Alimentarius and all the other stuff. No, because these are long-standing traditions of ways in which we've been able to take care of ourselves. It's very much a part of our sense of having rights to the land, to grow food, to have herd animals, you know, to take care of ourselves. We lose those rights, those things that...
Interesting. Okay, we'll try to get this back. Because something happened here.
Did you lose me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something must have knocked you off there.
Well, I was just on my soapbox for a while.
That's okay, but I was actually trying to bring up something on my other computer that had to do with something to do with the David Wolfe and Doug Harbison selling... the Sun Foods to, he's the son of a Monsanto CEO, but.
Oh, okay.
So
why
anyways.
Not? You know, you take every good thing and you parlay it up into the, you know, to the corporate mega business. And, you know, it seems like everything follows that path.
Well, I think the lesson to be aware of is, and this is, I've found this in almost quite a few of your natural foods and whole foods and you name it, that they are being bought up by the mega corporations and big pharma. So be aware of that, so that it, just because it says it's organic and you name it, there are plenty of them out there, like Mike Adams, a health ranger, and others trying to state, you know, raw and whatever. You need to be a little bit more aware of what's going on out there, because it is being, they're not leaving them out when it comes to the genetically modifying us, right?
Well, you know, if it says organic, it's not supposed to be genetically modified. Those are the rules. But the rules of organics are shifting sand. And this I know, you know, in the last few years, there's been quite a lot of changes made to the rules of what qualifies as organic. They've allowed many new pesticides in that were not previously listable as tolerable in organic foods. Now there's very many more. The percentages have been raised. So I know things are always changing. You know, it's like having a favorite thing that you go to the market for. There's something with a label on it, okay? Maybe it's your favorite salsa. And you've been buying the same product for 20 years. And one day you walk in there, you pick up your favorite salsa, and you just check the label. And suddenly you realize there are different ingredients in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, this wasn't in my salsa 20 years ago, but it's the same brand and it tastes the same to you. So this is how things happen by stealth. You know, it's just, you know, you're lucky if you've got something that has a label attached that you can compare. But so most things do not, obviously. And people that eat natural aren't even dealing with that. You know, you've got to be able to trust your source.
Right. And them talking about being able to grow your own food and whatever. There's so much legislation and things that are changing in the background that many of us are not aware. And that was why I brought up the bit about the recycled the sewage, because
right.
Now it's the infrastructure's there, and we need to be paying attention to that infrastructure, because it is the corporation that is the new government, that is the government, and it's always been the government, but it was allowed to hide behind the facade of the government structures. I know we have a constitution and all these other aspects, but it's as though the ethics of the corporation have now superseded our right to eat and our right to exist, and that the making money is and profit is what seems to be running. It is the motto of the corporation. So that's what our military and our medical industrial complex has come down is about, and our country is nothing but corporations. That even our cities and our counties and our every other aspect that government is now incorporated. So that's a little sidestep, but not really, because.
Well, you know, that's the nature of the battle people are in. You know, we're battling a lot of unified entities that are, you know, just beyond our own conception in terms of how big they are, how powerful they are. And obviously they're more powerful than our government in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Our government never allowed us to be powerful, though, but that is part of our history. You know, the direct voting and all this, I mean, the situation was even worse in the past. We think, you know, we've sort of moving into less and less freedom, but in fact, it's freedom we never had to begin with. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of creative responses. As long as people are able to recognize when something that's going on is controlled opposition. And I think that's probably the most important thing. And they're very hard lessons to learn. I think watching the 9/11 movement sort of take up these very false positions on things has been my way of learning about controlled opposition, you know, and how you seed these what eventually becomes like majority opinions, and how they manage to do that. I honestly, you know, I mean, I hate to sound like a full-blown cynic, but I really just don't believe that there are naturally spontaneously erupting grassroots movements anymore. I think that pretty much anything that gains a lot of momentum gets publicity, gets TV coverage, like, you know, Occupy Wall Street and all that. I mean, to me, that's all controlled opposition. I'm just going to accept that it is, you know. And then, you know, when I have an opportunity to hear about people making speeches or what they're doing or the fact that they're raising lots of money now, and I mean, this all kind of really gets the cynical treatment from me.
Uh-huh.
But I want to say something about viruses, though, before.
Okay, we bring it
we
to a close. we're just about
okay,
there to the end here, so.
We're just about at the end, so uh-huh. I want to say this. They knew by the year 2000 that the polio viruses that are in circulation in the world have all come from vaccines. They're all vaccine-derived polio viruses. Now, what I've learned along the way is that because poliovirus is small, and it's a small genome, that it's something that actually should have mutated itself out of existence. When there isn't a lot of genetic material there, you can't afford to have it change much. If it does change, it's most likely, the most likely thing is that that becomes dysfunctional. That gene fragment no longer works. And so out of dysfunction from mutating naturally, this should have just disappeared. Polioviruses should be gone. They shouldn't be here on the planet. And yet, we keep re-injecting people with vaccine-created viruses. This is how they're keeping it alive. I don't know how many viruses this would apply to, but I bet there's a lot more than just polio. So I know, since that shouldn't be here, that this is how they're taking control of us. You know, we're convinced that these are contagious diseases that occur naturally, but they are not. And the vaccines that support the disbursement and the continuation of something that should really have disappeared is very telling about how we're being moved into a bioengineered future. I think they plan to make post-humans out of us, which means that we won't have the same characteristics of species that we have now. We don't even appreciate what kind of characteristics we have as human beings. But it certainly is a lot more than what it takes to get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and go to work.
Well, so. Jennifer, I really have to appreciate all the work you've done and the mess and getting this message out, and that you continue to do so. Again, it's Jennifer. Oops, I lost the. I wanted to say your. Okay, jenniferlake.wordpress.com, and your other one is polioforever.wordpress.com. But your work is important, and in giving us the historical background of what's taking place with this bioengineering, I don't know if it's transhuman, transgenic, whatever you want to call it, we've got a lot of things in store for us, that, for those of us that, you know, weather it. So I really want to thank you again for coming on my program, and I hope we can do this again. And
thank you, Melody. I enjoy it, and I really appreciate the fact that TruthQuest posts its archives and that every show is available at any time anybody wants to go and listen. And I enjoy listening through your archives, too.
Well, thank you.